Leading Ideas Talks is brought to you by the Lewis Center for Church Leadership of Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. Subscribe free to our weekly newsletter at www.churchleadership.com/leading ideas. Leading Ideas Talks is brought to you by the ebook Right Questions for Church Leaders. Leaders don't need answers. Leaders must have the right questions. And this ebook offers key questions that can change the direction of a church. Right Questions for Church Leaders is available at churchleadership.com/books. Why do some congregations grow more quickly than others? In this episode, we speak with Reverend Matt Miofsky, the founding and lead pastor at The Gathering in St. Louis, about his co-authored book, 8 Virtues of Rapidly Growing Churches.
Welcome to Leading Ideas Talks, a podcast featuring thought leaders and innovative practitioners. I'm Douglas Poe, the director of the Lewis Center, and your host for this talk. Joining me is Reverend Matt Miofsky, the founding and lead pastor of The Gathering in St. Louis, Missouri. Our focus for this podcast is the virtues of rapidly growing churches. Matt, you have co-authored a book with Jason Biasi, 8 Virtues of Rapidly Growing Churches, that I believe can help any congregation to look at its core practices, and a book I believe that every congregation really should pick up and put to use. But I really want to begin our conversation by asking you, why did you all use the term virtue to describe the characteristics of rapidly growing churches?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, thanks for having me on, Doug. It's good to be with you. And, you know, I'll have to be honest. Part of that word was kind of a feeling that characteristic or attribute, you know, those were both alternatives, 8 attributes, 8 characteristics. That first of all, those words didn't seem to mean much. Maybe they're a little bit overused. They also didn't necessarily note something that was good, just the commonalities that things had. And we love the word virtue because, of course, it has a little bit of a root in the Christian tradition. But it also denotes these are not only 8 similarities, but these are 8 things that we think every church would do well to strive for. They don't just happen to be common characteristics, but they're actually aspirational. Every church, we think, ought to be going for these kinds of things anyway. So we just thought the nuance of the word virtue got at that better than just simply being 8 commonalities or 8 characteristics.
I really like the word aspirational that you're using because yeah. I think that it points to something that is important for congregations. And I appreciate the way you frame that because I think too often congregations think in terms of goals or, you know, if I can do this and sort of figure out how to accomplish it, then I'm done. But when you think aspirational, it means it's something that's ongoing. Was that sort of the hope that you all were having that this would be ongoing?
You know, that really was the hope. I didn't want to simply kind of come up with a recipe for churches. But what I loved about these is even in doing the research for these, and I can talk a little bit about kind of where the book came from. You know, Jason Biasi, the co-author, he came to me and it started out because he was interested in 5 Methodist churches that had grown to over 1,000 in worship, but were started in the past 10 years. And he said there were 5 at the time, at least. This was several years ago.
Right.
And he listed off the 5, and The Gathering in St. Louis, the church I pastor, was one of them. And he said, you know, I want to write this profile on these 5 churches. I think that'd be really interesting. And I kind of said to him, I said, you know, hey, Jason, respectfully, I don't think anybody wants to read that book.
That's funny.
And what I meant was, I don't think what people need, pastors, church leadership boards, parishioners, I don't think what they need is to hear about, you know, 5 churches that are, you know, quote unquote, hitting it out of the ballpark. I think what they need is to figure out what is it that we can do in our setting to take our ministry from where it is to where we want it to go, which for most churches, I think, is to, you know, reach younger, more diverse people for Jesus. And so I said, what if we use those 5 churches as a starting place, a launch pad? We brought in the pool, which we did. So let's look at churches All of them are growing rapidly, but some are in urban areas, some are in rural areas, some are led by men, some by women, predominantly black churches, white churches. I mean, just kind of look at a mixture and say, you know, in an environment where most churches are in decline, what are some of the virtues that these churches that are growing have? And so just in writing the book, Doug, it was one of these things that I noticed that as I was listening to people talking about their church, all these virtues are things we do at the gathering. But I thought as I listened to these other pastors, oh, we can do that better, or we can think about it differently. Or you know what? We used to emphasize that, but if I'm honest, we've let that slip over the past, you know, 3 or 4 years, and we need to make that a priority again. So these aren't so much boxes to check off, yeah, we have them, but more like, you know, how are you doing in this category, and how are you doing with this virtue? And all of them, I really do think, are ongoing practices, things that we, I think, ought to always be doing, but we've never quite accomplished. And in that sense, I think every church can pick it up and say, hey, we're doing pretty well here, but here's how we think we could do that better. And hey, we've really let this one slip. I think we need to put that one back on the forefront.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that what I really appreciated about the book is it really doesn't matter what size your congregation is, that when you engage the book, you will find something helpful in terms of what you can do in terms of trying to, as you be aspirational in the practices that you're living out. I want to pick up a little bit on what you were just talking about in terms of the congregations, because I think you shared an important insight in a book that we often miss. You say, don't try to copy or replicate what you read in the book. And I think it's also true when people attend workshops or events that, you know, they go and they get excited and they try to replicate or copy exactly what they heard. What is your suggestion for how we should apply or engage what we would learn from congregations like yours or the other congregations?
Sure. Well, you know what? What I always tell people is, I think, like, when we go to a workshop or when we go to a big church that maybe has a conference, and I think we get way too caught up in what churches are doing or how they're doing ministry. So we look at their worship and we say, well, they had a band and you know, they had great lights and their worship was 45 minutes long with just a sermon and some songs or whatever it is. But we really sort of obsess on like what they're doing and how they're doing it. So we kind of focus on the answers that those churches have arrived at. We try to export those answers into our setting. What I think is a better way to approach it, what we try to do in the book, is when you go to a workshop, when you go to a conference, when you go to some church that you think is doing it well, what were the questions they asked early on? Or what are the questions they're continuing to ask? And you can look at how they're answering them. You might get some best practices there, some insights. But I often think for most churches, just the questions themselves are important. You can export, take those back to your church and say, you know what, I think these are some really important questions we need to ask. Now, here's how church A, B, and C answered those questions. How would we answer the question? And you may find that you're similar to church A, B, or C, but you may find that you have some different answer, you know, answer D. But I think what's important is the questions. So like with our virtues here, we do certainly give best practices. We give insights that are common to all these churches, but we don't try to overprescribe. Here's how this virtue needs to look in your church. And in fact, I would urge churches, don't take a virtue and say, well, how did this play out at the gathering, or how did this play out at Church of the Resurrection, or something like that. But rather say, how would this play out for us? How would we live this virtue out? And the answer might be really different. And so I think it's an exercise, not simply in kind of a best practices or even primarily in that, but sort of here's a virtue. This is something that's true in growing churches, no matter what context they're in. And we that was intentional. We didn't want this to be about context so much. This isn't, well, here's a virtue that works just in cities or just in rural areas. But no, we threw a lot of virtues out, in fact, that we started with that seemed to be highly contextual. But these seem to be true just kind of wherever you are, growing churches are engaging this virtue. But we wanted to write it in such a way that said, this, we don't want to tell you how you need to do it or what you need to do with it, but we think this virtue needs to be on the radar screen of your church if you want to grow.
Yeah, I think that's helpful. It makes a lot of sense. The importance of asking questions. And we don't spend enough time really asking questions. We're always looking for the quick fix or for the answer.
Right.
What also struck me, and I really appreciated the way you approached this, you sort of talk about leaders being led by the Spirit. And my question is, how can a leader help a congregation to act like the Spirit is already at work? I think oftentimes our leaders believe or they have the faith, and they want to act like the Spirit is at work. But you also need the congregation to act like the Spirit is at work for the community to experience transformation. Do you have any insights of how you can help leaders to really help their congregation act like the Spirit is at work?
Yeah, there's a couple things I would say about that. You know, we wrote the first virtue in the book is rapidly growing churches believe in miracles and act accordingly. Yes. And what that's really about is this fundamental belief the Spirit is at work here, wanting to do incredible things. And our job is to kind of uncover what the Spirit is up to.
Right.
So I said the leaders who believe the Spirit is at work in their congregation or community end up being more bold than leaders who don't believe that. Because if you believe the Holy Spirit is up to something and doing things, then all of a sudden you'll ask for things or you'll do things or you'll expect things. It might seem a little bit crazy. Mm-hmm. But when the Holy Spirit's in the mix, all of a sudden it doesn't become so unrealistic. So leaders become more bold. But what I would say to help a church uncover a sense of that is I think one of the things that most that we don't think about enough in most churches is celebrating where the Spirit is at work in our congregation and just sort of relentlessly celebrating where we see the Spirit at work. I think most churches are so focused on kind of what's coming up next, Easter's right around the corner, what's on the calendar up ahead, that we forget to stop and to celebrate where we've seen the Spirit, the Holy Spirit at work in our congregation. And so at the gathering, you know, one of the things we've tried to do is build into worship regularly, weekly, certainly monthly, if not a couple times a month, just celebrations. And sometimes they're really big things, Doug, you know, like maybe we had a tremendous Christmas Eve offering that each year we give away to Mozambique, and that's a big celebration. Sometimes it's really small. Something that happened in the student ministry, last weekend that we think the whole congregation needs to know about is a sign that the Spirit is at work here. And we, you know, in our church, we record those. We do them as videos. In other churches, you could do them as live testimonies or even just a story that the pastor tells. But I think the more that you celebrate with people and point out, hey, look, that's the Spirit right there. And look over here. I don't know if y'all noticed this, but here's the Holy Spirit. Hey, we had 3 baptisms in the first quarter. That hasn't happened in 10 years. What a cool thing to celebrate. And the more you do that, the more people begin to, first of all, have a sense that, oh, something, God really is up to something here in our church. And secondly, they begin to do it then. Hey, pastor, I don't know if you saw this, but, you know, I wanted you to know this story. You know, when they hear you celebrating stories, they'll start to better be able to see those stories themselves.
That I think you're right, that people model sort of what the expectation is. So when celebration becomes a part of the ethos of the congregation, then that's modeled, then they're going to copy what they're experiencing.
Absolutely.
And this is, I thought, you talked about boldness, was really bold. You talk about in the book that churches do not close because they risk too much. And I just found that line really interesting, but I sort of want to take it in a slightly different direction. I'm wondering, what insights do you have to help churches maybe not go from 0 to 10, but from 0 to 1 or 2? Because I absolutely think you're 100% correct, but I also just, and you know this also, in dealing with congregations, it's hard to get them to go from 0 to 10 But if we can even get them to start going from zero to one, that can make a difference. Do you have any thoughts about how to help them to take that first step?
Yeah. You know, so Doug, I'm going to use an example that's a very kind of narrow example, but it illustrates, I think, a larger point that I think one small step a lot of churches could be willing to take is simply to be honest about evaluating where certain ministries are. So maybe you have so I'm going to use the example of a preacher because, you know, maybe there's some pastors listening to this and this gets really personal. You know, you might listen to certain preachers you admire, whoever that might be, or listen to podcasts and think, man, I just wish I could preach like that. I wish I could tell stories that way. I wish I had those same ideas for sermon series. And I suspect every preacher deep down kind of looks around and has a little bit of preacher envy. We look around and say, man, I wish I could do it like that. And then, but there seems like this huge gap. How would I ever get from where I am to, you know, some person I love listening to? And it seems insurmountable. And so we sort of go back to doing it our way. And one place to start, and I did this in my own preaching years ago, is one place to start is inviting people to evaluate your preaching. Hmm. And that step alone is really hard.
Absolutely.
It's really difficult to say, you know, every Thursday now I preach my sermon to a group of three staff. It could be congregation members too. And for a half an hour, I just tell them, just critique it. What made sense? What didn't? What connected with you? What didn't? What did you hear in it? How could it be better? And I'll tell you, Doug, it's really painful sometimes to sit there. And what you really want them to say is, oh, Pastor, that was just such a great, great message.
Right,
you know,
that's
I just poured hours of my life into it. But what you actually invite them to do is to begin to evaluate. Well, of course, that's only a small part of what it means to get better, but it's a really critical first step. And so to take that, and I tell churches, you might look at worship at some church and say, God, I wish our worship could look like that. It's got this amazing band and or organist or whatever it is. And then you look at yours and you say, we're so far from that. I don't see how we could ever get there. One small step that I think every church could do is just beginning to be more comfortable with honest evaluation.
Yeah.
Let's just be honest about where is our worship right now? What works? What doesn't work? What isn't connecting? Can we ask, you know, are the musicians or are the pastors or the liturgists or the people who work on it, are they sort of comfortable enough in their own skin that they can get five people out of the congregation together and say, just tell us honestly, kind of where do you think worship is? Where does it need to go? It's not a big step, but I think it's a critical first step in going from where we are to somewhere new, where we hope to be or where we want to be.
No, I appreciate your answer. And I think that it's you're right on target. And it's very practical. And it's something, again, that every congregation can take that step and it can make a difference in what they're doing. I think my favorite line in the book was this next part where tongue-in-cheek, you all write, every dying church has a community garden. And then you say, of course, we have a community garden. but your point, of course, is really about discipleship. And I think discipleship is one of those terms we use often, but I'm not sure people have a clear understanding of what discipleship is. Can you talk about, from your perspective, what is discipleship? And how can we be more intentional about actually doing it or helping to help people to become disciples?
Well, first of all, it's funny that you lift up that line because it was tongue-in-cheek, and it's simultaneously the line people love and the line people hate. I mean, we've gotten several emails, hey, we have a community garden. I can't believe you're making fun of the community garden, and that's important, and in our community, and we have to backpedal and say, wait, of course, a community garden might be a fine idea.
Right.
Just like the cycling club on Saturday morning, or the volleyball league that uses the gym, or the knitting club that meets there. I mean, so it wasn't so much meant to, you know, poke fun at community gardens, but to say that one virtue of rapidly growing churches is they put a disproportionate amount of time and energy on we call it in the book integrating new people quickly, but it's really about discipleship. So they realize that as good as all these activities might be, and I think particularly Methodist churches, we are good at activities.
Yes.
I mean, typically I'll go to a church and they'll tell me about all the things they do, you know, and they could list, you know, 10, 11, 12, 20, 30 groups and things that meet in the church. But when I ask them a simpler question, tell me, how does someone who's new become a deeply committed follower of Christ in your church? What do you do with them? First of all, what is a deep disciple? Have you defined that or figured that out for yourself yet? And if you have, what are the steps or what are the processes that you use to take a new person and lead them to that place of deep discipleship? And most of the time, I get a little bit of a glaze. People look at me a little bit glazed over. And notice in that, I'm not telling churches what their definition of a deep disciple has to be. I think this is one of the instances of the questions we were talking about earlier. You have to come up with your own answer, but what's a deep disciple of Jesus for you? And I think different churches are going to define that differently. And then the next question is, what processes do you have in place that are intentionally leading people to that? And are they working? Are they effective? And for me, discipleship, I mean, I could get theological about discipleship. We could talk biblically about it. But I'm talking now, kind of practically speaking. However you answer those questions, what we found is that rapidly growing churches put a lot of time and energy on that core process of when a new person walks in our door, here is what we are offering them in order to get them to a place of deep discipleship. And the answers can vary widely. And so what I find in a lot of churches is it's been a long time since they've really thought about that. Traditionally, and I would say I used to be this way, we kind of think like, hey, if they come to our church, that's step one. If they come back, that's kind of step two. And let's just get them connected to something. Put them on a committee, get them in a Sunday school class, you know, sign them up as an usher, and our job here is done. And what we're saying is, no, our job really isn't done. It's just beginning. So what's your church's process for a new person? And how would they become a deeply committed follower of Jesus? That's really what that's about.
Yeah, no, I think that, again, that's right on target. And I believe at the end where you were talking about the way many congregations approach the topic is, you know, you come a couple of times and if we can get you on a committee or in a ministry, then we've done our job. But we haven't actually thought about how do we help people become deeply committed followers of Christ. And it's something that all congregations really need to take seriously, and unfortunately not enough do.
I think that's right. Yeah.
One of the things that, again, I think was helpful is that you suggest that churches need to avoid being pulled in 100 different directions. And really, you know, the key is you really need to sort of figure out your core focus and make sure that you're really staying true to that core focus. How have you been able to develop sort of that core focus at the gathering? You know, what was it that helped you to sort of figure that out so that you weren't being pulled in all these different directions?
Right. Well, I'll say that, you know, I started the church as a new church 12 and a half years ago. And part of it back then was just by virtue of the fact that we didn't have a lot of resources and didn't have a lot of people, we couldn't right off the bat sort of reproduce a full-blown ministry that mimicked a church that had been around for 50 years. So, and I know there were a lot of people in the early years of the gathering that were really troubled that we didn't have an older adult ministry and a mom's ministry and a women's ministry and a men's ministry and a youth ministry and kids ministry and a choir. And I mean, we were just trying to have worship and get some people in small groups. And that was about all that we had the bandwidth to do. I think as a church gets larger or has more resources, the temptation is to just keep adding to the portfolio, so to speak. Well, now let's do this, and let's do this, and let's do this. And so the challenge for us has been as we get larger and as people expect us to have every niche ministry that they want to see in a church, how good it we are. We have to get good and stay vigilant about saying no to various things and saying, at this church, we really highly value and lift up these three things. And this is kind of what we're about. And I can give a lot of examples of that. And so that's helped us to excel at what we're really gifted to excel in and not get pulled apart or distracted or kind of everything kind of grows thin when you try to overextend yourselves, your ministry, your staff, or your people. And I think probably everybody can identify who's listening. In some way, you look at your church and you think, we can't get enough volunteers for the things that we have. We certainly can't add one more thing or two more things. And I think that's a feeling that a lot of churches have. So if we're going to get good at a few things, it probably means we're going to have to stop doing a couple of things and then say no to some good future things, but things that don't fit kind of what we think we're uniquely gifted in. And I should say, Doug, I mean, I have a kind of theory of the church that God doesn't need every church to be good at everything, but God lifts up all sorts of different churches that have different gifts, that are good at different things, that are uniquely capable of reaching certain groups of people. And together, the kingdom, right. there's a holistic way in which God uses every church to complement what God's trying to accomplish in a place. And so I tell churches, I don't think God needs you to be good at everything, but God needs you to be really good at a few things. So what is it that God, you think, has uniquely gifted your church to do? And don't get so distracted that you might not look the same as the church down the street or the church you grew up in or the large church you used to attend when you lived somewhere else.
I think, again, that was helpful, but a piece of it that I really picked up on, and I hope listeners picked up on this also, was you talked about when you started off, you didn't have a lot of resources. And I think oftentimes we equate, you have to have resources to be effective right. in ministry. But it actually ended up being a blessing in disguise for you because it actually helped you to focus more on finding what are our true gifts and then living those gifts out even as you started to grow. And I think that what takes place is what you just said, people grow and then they try to do everything instead of sticking with that blessing they probably had of, you know, this is what we have been gifted by God to do.
I think you're exactly right, Doug. In fact, sometimes I think more resources, particularly money, actually makes this more difficult. It ends up getting in the way. When you're smaller and scrappier, you sort of have to choose. You have to exercise that. So I always tell people, you know, when the gathering started, as crazy as it sounds, we just said in the beginning, like we thought we were uniquely gifted to reach people in their 20s and 30s, single, maybe married with young kids. So we just said off the bat, we are not going to have a youth ministry. We're just not going to have it. We don't have the resources for it. We can't be good at multiple things. So we're going to try to be good at kids ministry. Like we're going to start, put all our resources in that basket. And we're just not going to have a youth group because we don't have enough people, critical mass, all that kind of stuff. And of course, that was really difficult because we'd get people in the first few years who said, we love your church, Matt, but I've got a teenager. What do you have for teenagers? And I'd be really tempted to overpromise. Oh, you know, we're going to get a youth group going. And what we did is we said, you know what? The truth is we don't have a strong youth ministry. We don't have any youth ministry right now. What we're really focused on are these things. But here's some other churches that are really have strong youth ministries, and we recommend those. Now, that's a really hard thing to do when you're small and wanting people to come to your church. But we actually found that it helped us over a few years to get really good at what we were focusing on. And then, you know, we grew from there. So in time, we did add a student ministry and a youth ministry. But there was quite a few years in our early days where we just had to admit to ourselves, we're not going to do this. It's not what God has uniquely kind of gifted us to do.
You also talk about in the book, not in the way that I'm going to ask you this question, but you talk about sort of understanding that individuals understand their role in relation to the mission. I'm going to change it up a little bit and ask you, how do you help leaders of different ministry areas to actually live out this idea of understanding their role in relationship to the mission? Because I often think that people get involved because they're passionate about something and they have ideas and they want to sort of do those things, but their ideas may not necessarily connect to the mission of the church. And you want them to be passionate, but it's also important that it still is connected to the mission.
Right. Well, so I'll talk to churches who happen to have the resources to hire people, and I know most churches, it's volunteer. But I think it starts with the kind of people that you pick to lead ministries, whether those are paid or unpaid. I'll call them unpaid staff. So I think all those in churches know that there are some people that work like a paid staff person. They just don't get paid. I think one way to pick those people is to say, hey, I need someone to, you know, lead our kids ministry. So I'm going to pick the person that's just the best at working with kids. You know, they love working with kids. They have a degree in, child education, and they, work in a nursery throughout the week. And I'm going to pick the person who's just the best at working with kids. And we don't necessarily think about, is that person passionate about our church? Are they passionate about the mission of our church? Do they have a love of God that they want to share with others? That's, some of these other questions. And so we kind of think we'll get around to that. So much so, and I know this is kind of controversial, so much so that we will actually hire experts in a ministry area that may not even go to our church or don't ever intend to be members of our church.
Right.
But they're good at finances, or they're good at kids, or they're good at music. Well, another way to approach that, and I think it gets at the question you're asking, is don't start with who's an expert at kids, ministry or music or finances, but say, who loves our church? Who seems to really understand our mission? Who seems to have personally had a meaningful experience of how our church has changed their life and now want to see that offered to other people? And find those people and then ask kind of, what are they good at?
Right.
Oh, you have a gift for finances. Let's kind of, maybe you could help us in the area of finances. Or, you have a gift of music. Maybe you can be involved in our music ministry. So I think it's kind of reversing what we look for. So I think it starts there. It starts with kind of how we identify those people. And maybe moving away from thinking of competency or how good they are at something as the first criteria. The second thing I would say is once people are in place and churches get busy and they're going, one of the roles of the pastor can be constantly almost badgering people about how they're staying connected to the mission of the church. So let's take a simple mission statement. Ours is to invite new people to become deeply committed followers of Christ. People almost get tired of me asking. If I drop into a ministry meeting, they're going to do Vacation Bible School, let's say this summer, and they're planning the week and what it's going to look like, and they're arguing about whether it should be in the day or the night, and what the activity should be. Right. And you drop in there and you say, hey, it looks like you guys are doing good work. Hey, tell me, how is Vacation Bible School going to invite new people to become deeply committed followers of Christ? Now, at first, people just stare at you.
Right.
They might kick you out of the meeting. They might tell you to go mind your own business.
Right.
But then you say, somebody comes to you with a new ministry idea, and they're telling you all about it. The first thing I ask, tell me how this invites new people to become deeply committed followers of Christ. And if the answers are too convoluted, or too disconnected, or too indirect, then I know I've got a problem in a ministry area where people aren't really thinking about that. And so I'm just constantly asking that question. And after a while, people move from maybe annoyance or anger or defensiveness, over time, though, they'll start asking the question. So when you pop into the meeting, they'll all laugh and say, okay, Matt, we know what you're going to ask, and here's what we're thinking on how VBS this year is going to think about inviting new people. Right. And it takes time, and I'm not saying it happens overnight, but there's a real diligence, I think, on the part of the leader to constantly be reminding people of what we're trying to do here.
Yeah, the modeling aspect again.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So, Matt, as we get ready to bring this to a close, I want to ask you one more question. And I believe that, particularly in our culture today, that this is a critical point that you all help people to think about more deeply. You say growing churches do well at engaging skeptics. And of course, there are more skeptics today based up in every sort of Pew survey or any other survey that we see nationally. Can you share how you have learned to do this well and any insights for others to do it well?
Sure, yeah. I'll rattle off a few things, Doug. I think one is it's important to continue to be friends with normal people. I say that sort of half jokingly,
right.
Meaning if you look around and say, you know, Matt, all my friends go to church. I'll talk sometimes about this. And this, you know, say, I know you always want us to invite people, but all my friends already go to church. You know what I say to them, Doug, is I say, you know what? You need to get some new friends.
That's right. Yes.
And I really mean that. Right. I mean, it starts with, so as a pastor or a preacher, I think a lot of pastors know we can easily fill up 40, 50, 60 hours of our week with insider church stuff and being around insider church people. So it starts by almost making it a spiritual discipline to be listening to and forming relationships with people who aren't in the church yet. And that's simple, but it's hard to authentically speak to skeptics if you don't know any, and you don't share meals with any, and you don't ever ask them how they see things or what they struggle with, and why is church, you know, why are they turned off to church? So the more you hear it and are around it, the easier it is for you to begin to think about those people when you write messages. So I think it starts there. I think a second thing is to the extent that you can, remember those times in your own life when faith was hard. You know, if you came to faith as an adult, you can literally remember a time when you didn't know Christ or didn't think about Christ, and then kind of how you were drawn into that relationship. So that's great. But I know a lot of us grew up in the church. If you're like me, I grew up in the church all my life, but there were still seasons, you know, when I was in college, when I was a young adult, I can remember seasons when faith didn't make sense. I was growing maybe skeptical or tired about it. So tapping back into those own experiences and remembering that, we weren't always where we are right now, but we've had to go through certain things. And it makes us, I think, more empathetic to people who are currently, you know, maybe going through those things. And then finally, this is just kind of a practical thing. When we preach and teach, I think sometimes we assume that our job is to convince people. So to sort of predict what the skeptic might say and then try to convince them with argument, or, you know, there's old apologetics classes, you know, some pastors right. might have taken an apologetics class. It was a kind of how to answer every question, how to spar with a person who doesn't believe, so to speak. And what I've found is that, you know, sometimes there's a place for that, but most of the time that's not what people are struggling most with. It's not so much about an argument as it is about relationships and so I think instead of arguing with a person or coming off as defensive or having all the answers or trying to convince you, sometimes simply naming what you know people are uncomfortable with goes a long way in establishing credibility. So I'll give you a simple example. Money, you know, preaching about money, a lot of pastors struggle with it. They know it's taboo in a lot of places. And so they might come out strong. You know, Jesus talks about money all the time, and this is really important. And if you're not thinking about money, then you're not really following Jesus. And there's space for all that. But sometimes the best thing that you can do is just stand up there and say, you know what? I bet when you heard I was going to talk about money, you know, part of you was like, I don't know if I want to go to church today.
Right.
You're not going to say like, I understand that, you know, if it's weird for you, imagine what it's like for me. Or hey, I know a lot of you are, you know, you're really, you want to give, but you look at your own life and you're stressed out. You're stretched to the max. You, maybe have, already have too many obligations. You don't know where it's going to come from. And so just the topic itself is uncomfortable because money is something that in a lot of our personal lives is already stressing us out. I mean, I think something simple by saying, you know, I get it. I understand what you're coming in with. So let's talk about that. What do we do with that together? Rather than you're where you are and I'm where I am and my job is to convince you. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. And I think, it's helpful for individuals to hear that because still too often people are trying to convince through apologetics or trying to debate with others instead of taking the approach you've outlined.
On the next Leading Ideas Talks, we speak with Reverend Dr. Jackie Lewis of Middle Collegiate Church about multicultural and multiracial congregations, plus the joys and challenges of being a multi-ethnic congregation.
And I don't think God's story for us is a linear, never-to-be-changed story either, just to be honest. But if I think I'm in community with other human beings who are in community with the Holy One, perfecting the universe, right? Healing the universe is the end of our story, the telos of our story. That's liberating and empowering. And I think if preachers could get clear that that's our aim, is to help our congregants, no matter who they look, no matter how they look, no matter who they love, no matter how they are, to cast themselves in the God story. Like, that's what I say to preachers when I'm teaching preaching. Our job is to help people find their way into that story and see themselves as agents and actors and powerful people inside that story.
Thank you for joining us. And don't forget to subscribe free to Leading Ideas at churchleadership.com/leadingideas.